Welcome to the breeding class. We're dealing with Christian ethics, and this week we're going to begin a subsection on work. And in all the stuff that I read on Christian ethics, work doesn't get a lot of attention, and yet I'm struck by the fact that a good bit of our time is spent in work every day. Just about as much as we sleep, we work. Everything else basically falls into the third category of etc. Most of us, when we talk about work in respect to the Christian message, we're thinking of works as they relate to our relationship with God. Good works will not save us, but they will bear witness to the one who does. And in that respect, there are really two witnesses. There are many witnesses, but two witnesses that stand out with respect to our Christian faith as we live it in the world. One is the empty tomb of God's Son, and the other is the ethical testimony of God's saints. So the way in which we live our lives is very important. But when we look at the average daily schedule, nearly a third of it is spent working. So the platform where we expect or should expect to basically give a lot of attention would be, how do we live out our Christian life in the world of our work? We give a lot of attention to the family, to relationships with neighbors, so forth and so on, to church life, etc. But oftentimes work gets neglected. Now, because this is going to be a very brief, probably two-session thing on work, I'm going to give you a reading assignment. You've got these eight books that I want you to cover before next week in preparation for next week's class. Not really. Probably no one here, or very few people, have actually read books on the ethics of work. But if you're so inclined, and I hope some of you will be, these are eight books that I'd recommend. Not necessarily all of them. Number one, Timothy Keller's book, Every Good Endeavor. This is recently published. Almost everything Tim Keller writes that's worth reading, and this is no exception. I don't agree with him on every point, but he really, I think, does a very good job of addressing in a serious way what it means to be a Christian at work. Two other books, Just Business and Your Work Matters to God. One published by InterVarsity Press, the other by NAV Press. Both of these are good, solid treatments of the ethics of work. But they don't have quite the sensitivity that Keller's book does. The late Richard John Newhouse speaks from a very unique perspective. He was a socialist Christian who represented the left wing politically and economically, and went through a conversion process in terms of his political thinking later in life, and became a part of what came to be known as neoconservatives economically, and converted to the Catholic faith from the Lutheran faith. But he's writing a response to the Pope's encyclical on ethics and work. Very thoughtful and helpful work. I love the title, Doing Well and Doing Good, a critique of capitalism and Christianity. These books are more secular. The classic Max Weber's book, The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, basically links modern Western capitalism with the Protestant work ethic and Protestant theology. And this remains a must read for people who are serious about linking religion and culture. Economic Facts and Fallacies by Thomas Sowell. Some of you are familiar with Thomas Sowell. Very helpful book. Lots, if you basically are confused by what you're really seeing in the media, he will help you sift through what is fact and what is fiction. And then Moral Business, and Moral Business is basically a big, thick anthology on essays on morality and business. If you want a book, if you're in business and want a book on ethics, this is a good place to start, because it'll cover every field in responsible, sensitive, and sensitive detail. And then for the common good is a long and serious essay calling people to critique big business and move toward an emphasis on small businesses and the environment in terms of practicing Christian ethics. And not Christian ethics, but ethics generally. And his argument largely is the fact that when you get big business and big government, ethics becomes complicated and difficult. It's much easier on a local scale and with small business. But anyway, that's just a thumbnail sketch of that. If you're going to get one book, start with Timothy Keller's. There are other very good books too, but these are eight that I'd recommend. But a good place to start, if we're going to talk about ethics and work, is to start where the scripture starts, in the first chapters of Genesis. It is interesting that when the narrative of the biblical description of God and the world begins, one of the first things we learn about God is that He works. We see Him as the Creator. And not only that, He commissions mankind, made in His image, to first of all, work. Work becomes a big theme at the very beginning of the creation narrative. Genesis chapter 1 and verse 28. God blessed them, that is, Adam and Eve. And God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it, and rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over every living thing that moves on the earth." The first point that I think we must say with respect to the ethics of work is this: show up for work. In other words, we should look at work not as a burden to be avoided or to be rid of, but something that we should actually look forward to and welcome. Work can be and should be a blessing. Now, for reasons that we're going to get to in chapter 3 of Genesis, it has a curse associated, not with the work, but with the environment in which we do work. It's not going to be easy. But the first thing I think we should note in talking about the ethics of work is the fact that we should roll up our sleeves and welcome it. Sam Ewing, the former baseball player, put it this way, and it's appropriate: hard work spotlights the character of people. Some turn up their sleeves, some turn up their noses, some don't turn up at all. And George Carlin, not my favorite comedian, but he often hits the nail on the head, put it this way: "Oh, you hate your job. Why didn't you say so? There's a support group for that. It's called Everybody. They meet at the bar." A newly released Gallup report showed that 70% of Americans polled either hate their job or are disengaged from their work. And even perks don't make their nullify an unhappy arrangement with their managers or those who work with them or over them. And again, I go back to what's her first name? Bell.
Bell Hooks.
Bell Hooks. Thank you. Thank you, Cece. Bell Hooks, and again, someone who ordinarily I would never read, but her book, It's All About Love, I think is classic. Bell Hooks is a black feminist activist. She basically grew up, from what I can tell, an evangelical home, became a Buddhist in her search for significance, been married five times, been through five or more different career changes. She should know what she's talking about. And when you read her book, It's All About Love, she's got some terrific insights. One of the things she said...
What? She's talking about.
She's had experience. When you read her, when I read her book, It's All About Love, I was impressed. Not with her record, but with her insights. We are most productive, she notes, and happy when we are teamed with others we love and who love us. And she goes so far as to say, in her experience in several different careers, she found that at the end of the day, it was far better to have or to be underemployed and to be working at something that was not necessarily your first choice if you're working with people who you love and who love you and who know you. The secret to happiness at work is the people you choose to work with as much as the kind of work you do. I think she's on to something there. Our relationships basically make a huge difference. And many of you who are in a working situation, some of you are retired, but many of you are in a working situation now, will probably attest to that. When you think about your work, I would suggest that the first thing that comes to your mind is the people you're working with. If they love you and you love them, if they understand you, and you work together, that makes a huge difference in the way in which you think about your work. It'll trump even the other factors of compatibility with work. What Cece and I told our children as they grew up, with respect to their careers and vocations, went something like this. In several different ways, we tried to say, get in touch with the deepest desire of your heart, what God has designed you to do, and then seek to make a living with it. If you have a passion to be an artist, you may be poor, but you're going to be happiest poor doing what you passionately enjoy doing and with people that you want to work with than gaining money all your life so that when you're 80 years old you can retire and do what you want. And for many people, that's exactly the way they look at it. I'd like to do this, but to do that I've got to have a lot of money with the freedom to do that. So I'll spend the first 60 years of my life gaining the money so I can do what I want to do when I retire. Now that's when you think about that, that's a crazy way to look at life. Don't pick a job with a great vacation in mind. Pick one that doesn't need escaping from. Again, saying the same thing. Many of us in this room have been privileged in the sense that we are would be considered probably a white-collar or educated blue-collar group of people. We've had choices. Most of the world does not have many choices or choices at all in terms of what they're going to do. And in that respect, the whole matter of ethics doesn't start with getting a job for which you're compatible. It basically involves adjusting to a job to which you're not compatible. I can remember speaking to my father, who was a farmer. He did not finish elementary school. He grew up at a time when he had to take over the family farm to support the family. He did not have a choice. He could have been an athlete or a musician. His passions were in those areas, but he did not have that option growing up. He did those things on the side as he had time. But he had talent in those areas. And I'm sure he told me if he'd had his choice, he would have done something other than running a farm. But he happily adjusted to running a farm. My recollections of my father growing up, among other things, were seeing him repair broken machinery and singing. I can remember as a boy, hearing him sing, he had a good voice, hearing him sing while he was repairing machinery over and over again. But that was one of the ways in which he made peace with his situation.
The frustration of the broken machinery, that's how he dealt with it.
That's right, that's how he dealt with it. He was an extremely patient person. Genesis chapter 2, verse 15. Here's the second point in biblical work ethics. Work with God's purposes in view. Then the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to cultivate and keep it. Now, the pictures we have of in Sunday school books of the Garden of Eden stick in our mind. But I think it's important for us to read the first chapters of Genesis as a literary myth. Now, that doesn't mean that it didn't happen. It means that what's being pictured here is something bigger than just the painting of the Garden of Eden and Adam and Eve in it. These pictures depict life itself. They depict something. They're a myth in the sense that they are a model, a template against which we understand and see life. And what this passage is saying, I believe, is this, that one of the first responsibilities God gives man is basically to give attention to his environment, to preserve it, and to bring it out, to cultivate it, to recognize its potential, to enhance that, make it useful, and to preserve it. Now that can be extended to communities, it can be extended to relationships, it can be extended to our environment, certainly, to a number of areas. But the idea is, we are here not to be spectators. We are here basically to recognize we have a purpose, and the purpose is related to getting the most out of the environment we're in, socially, environmentally, and in other respects as well. Success is being and doing in a manner that respects God's gifts, represents God's priorities, and reflects God's character. If I were going to search for a definition of success, this would be one I would choose. There are lots of possible definitions. But when I think of success, I would describe it this way. It's not just doing, but it's being and doing, in a way that respects the gifts that God has given us individually, that is, our passions and our strengths, represents God's priorities. Those gifts are used for the things that are important to God and to His kingdom, and reflects God's character. We do it in a way that allows the image of God to be seen through us. The way in which we do things, very important. And I'm going to today talk about four ways in which we can be derailed on that. I'm going to call them the demons in the workplace. The first is this. This is the blue-collar demon, I'm going to call it. The labor is a burden to be avoided as much as possible. Here the emphasis is on making it until retirement, or at least until the weekend. When I was in high school, I had an opportunity to work road construction on the interstate system as it was being built through South Dakota. That was just after they took the stagecoach away. For the first time in my life, I had an opportunity to be involved in a job where I was paid a wage that wasn't farm work. Growing up on a farm, there aren't a lot of opportunities for jobs like that. But the real education that I received there was being introduced to a culture that I had not experienced in my home or in my family. A group of men who worked, and they viewed their work as labor. It was something that they had to do until Friday night. They got paid weekly. They insisted on that. They'd get their paycheck, they'd go into town, and they'd get drunk. And the drunk would carry over until Saturday night. And if there's any money left, they'd save it for snacks during the week. Junk food on the job kind of thing. Some of them had families at one time. Most of them had abandoned their family or were not yet married, yet they had lots of girlfriends kind of thing. It was a culture I wasn't exposed to. but very enlightening, or darkening, I should say, in many respects. The point I took away from that experience was that these guys looked at work as labor, something they had to do just to get to Friday night so they could get their check, go into town, and have a good time, and have it last as long as possible until they had to go to work Monday morning again. And they seemed to be content doing that week after week. One of the things that I remember David, our son, said after he spent a summer in high school working as an electrician's assistant in Durham, he said, "Dad," he said, "this has convinced me I need to go to college." He said, I didn't. It wasn't just the work. He said, "I don't want to be a part of that culture." Now, I don't mean to say that electricians have a bad culture. There are lots of different electricians. But there are a lot of jobs in white-collar business, blue-collar business, that basically create a culture that basically looks at work as labor. It's something to a burden to be avoided. I'm saying this is the first demon. The violation of the first call that God puts on our life, and that is to basically give attention to the creation He has started, and now we're asked to cultivate and to preserve, to continue. We are an extension of His providence in that sense. The curse of the fall is not work, but rather the environment in which work takes place. Work is not a penalty for man's sin. Man was commanded to work before the fall, but after Adam and Eve's fall from grace, after their transgression and sin, all of a sudden that work then became difficult and frustrating. The environment was cursed. The second demon is what I'm going to call the green collar demon. Work as a means to financial status. The emphasis here is on making a fortune. The goal here is to be the richest person in the cemetery at the end. And this culture basically sees net worth as a way of keeping score in the pecking order of self-worth. I can remember talking to a psychiatrist friend of mine in Dallas, Texas, who lived in North Dallas, which is an affluent area part of Dallas. And he had a large business, several different counseling centers, so forth and so on. And he was able to have a very nice house and live in an upwardly mobile social environment, so forth and so on. And he said, when we were staying with him one summer, he said, in North Dallas, there is a class system. And the class system is based upon your net worth. And it's something that is not subtle. It's basically up front. And you know where you are in the pecking order of the society by which parties you get invited to. And once your net worth, say, goes from $5 million to $25 million, you get invited to different parties. And when you basically get there, you're welcomed into that club, that elite. Now, the 25 million people are looking for the $100 million people. That's the people they want to go to next, so forth and so on. But he said there's this kind of scorekeeping going on in terms of your success. Your value is measured by your net worth. That's not the kind of thing you see in an academic community, usually. In an academic community, it's measured differently. We're going to see that in a bit. I just want to say a word about competition. Competition in the demon of the green collar, where basically work is a means of acquiring wealth, competition becomes very important. And one of the sacred cows in our culture, which we're going to talk about next week, is competition. You don't criticize competition in the free enterprise capitalistic system. And I'm going to suggest that we should. Competition is good, but only when linked with cooperation and compassion. When competition does not have cooperation or compassion associated with it, we've got a problem as Christians. I don't think that competition is incompatible with Christianity, but it is when there is no compassion or cooperation. And that is something that I think is a touchy subject. I can remember, I've used this example before, but when I was a seminary student, one of the guys in our class was one of these uncommonly gifted individuals. He was tall, dark, and handsome, thin, and bright, very spiritual, athletic, musical. There's nothing he couldn't do. Come from a great family. I can remember when we played basketball, everybody would want David, that's his name, on your team because he was the best athlete. And he was effortless. I can remember watching him play touch football, and many of us would just want to watch him run. It was like a deer. Whether he's on your side or not, you just wanted to watch him run. It was so pretty. But I can remember one afternoon we were in the gym. On Saturdays we played basketball, went to the local gym. And we were in the middle of a heated pickup game. And halfway through the game, four little kids came into the gym and sat in the corner with their basketball. And immediately, when David noticed them, he took himself out of the game. Right in the middle of the heat of the competition, had someone else come in for him, and he went over and sat down with those boys and started talking to them and spent the rest of the morning with those little kids. And that was him. His focus was not on the competition of the game he was involved in. It was his sensitivity to neighborhood kids who had wandered into the gym. We were so frustrated with him. We needed him on our team. But yet, I reflected often on that experience. I can remember how frustrated I was that he dropped off out of our team because we needed him to win. But I often go back to that and say, you know, he had a measure of the Spirit of Christ in him that all of us weren't learning in the classroom, but we're learning outside the classroom by just watching his priorities and watching the way in which he viewed competition, etc. And I've often thought about that, that experience, and probably I hope I'll never forget it. The third demon, I'm going to call the white-collar demon, where work becomes a messiah or a source of my soul's identity in life. The emphasis here is on making a difference. Now, we live in a community, a white-collar academic community, where this is the major demon. The demon lives here. Where basically we would not necessarily be committed to making a fortune and being the richest person in the cemetery when we die. We would not necessarily look at work as a burden. Matter of fact, we love, many of us, love our work. We can't wait to get to work. We carry our work home with us, gleefully, joyfully. But that work has taken on something of a messianic role in our life. It has become the source of life itself for us. We can't imagine what life would be like if we didn't have this to do. And the danger here is just that the work becomes something that is good, but it replaces the best. It becomes something that basically gives significance and meaning to our life. We are a culture, as I said before, that tends to worship at work, work at play, and play at worship. And the worship at work is an expression whereby we find in our work something of a messianic significance. That is, it gives to us, or it becomes the source of that which gives to us the greatest sense of feeling alive. And I've often talked about the difference between a functional Messiah and a figurehead Messiah. If I were to ask you who is your Messiah, you would probably say Jesus Christ. But I would suggest that the functional Messiah may be different in your life than the figurehead Messiah. Jesus is a figurehead Messiah for many people, but the functional Messiah is who you make your sacrifices to. Who or what gives you a sense of being alive most? What do you make your biggest decisions around? Who has the biggest influence in terms of who you marry, where you live, what you spend your time with? What do you spend loosing on or daydreaming about in idle times of your life? What do you think about when you go to bed at night and think about when you get up in the morning? I'm going to suggest that will give you a hint as to what your functional Messiah is. And for many of us who are serious about our Christian faith, when we are critically analyzing our own soul, auditing our own soul, we have to face the fact that in some cases, our functional Messiah is not Jesus. He is not basically what makes our motor run. And we know that's true when the real functioning Messiah is taken away from us. When we lose our job. When basically we aren't successful in the way we expect to or need to be. When we don't get recognized for what we've done. So forth and so on. How we respond in those situations will tell us a lot about where our real Messiah is. And this, I think, is a significant challenge for us. Again, we are privileged, many of us, because we've had the privilege of choosing something that we're passionate about, choosing a vocation and work that is well suited for our talents and gifts. And I'm going to suggest that there are many people in ministry who love the ministry more than Christ. I would suggest there are people who are pastors who love people, even church people, more than Christ. Now, that sounds harsh and cruel, but I believe from my experience and observation, that happens a lot. And it's those functional messiahs, those false messiahs, that oftentimes get encouraged by the culture without realizing it. So when we talk about work ethics, one of the first things that I think we've got to really give attention to is are these demons. These things that basically distract us from our real purpose. And that is taking the gifts God has given us, aligning them with His priorities, and doing it His way, as opposed to being sidetracked. There's one more demon. I'm going to call that the red collar demon, where vocation as a calling or sacred ministry is emphasized. The emphasis here is on providential ministry. Now, I mention this because in the Reformed tradition, John Calvin and Martin Luther lived at a time in history where the Catholic Church made a big distinction between the religious, that is the orders, priests and nuns, and the laity. The laity largely were spiritually inferior. If you're really serious about your faith, you went into a religious state, into part of the religious community. The clergy and the laity were separate. One of the insights that came to Martin Luther in the Reformation was the breaking down of that class system in the church. And John Calvin followed suit. The priesthood of all believers was emphasized. And what that meant is that the cobbler and the horseman and the farmer were just as called as the priest or the pope, even. We all had a role, and that role was sacred. It was a calling through which God was going to use us in His creation. Now, that became a doctrine in the Protestant work ethic. A lot of the Protestant work ethic's DNA in the founding of early America had to do with the sacredness and the holiness of secular, quote-unquote, callings with respect to work. Now, I think that, the idea of a priesthood of the believer and the notion of breaking down a class system in the kingdom of God, perfectly legitimate, perfectly appropriate, needed. Here's the problem. When we make every vocation a sacred calling, we elevate it in a way in which at least the New Testament does not. There's no hint in the New Testament that I can see where our work, quote-unquote, in the world, vocationally, is seen as a sacred calling. I don't see Paul's work in making tents as referred to as a sacred calling, or Peter's work as a fisherman as a sacred calling. Now, I'm not suggesting that their work was not done as though it was done unto the Lord. It was, if they're following Christ. But the vocation itself was not necessarily the calling. It was the way in which they engaged with the world, period, including their work. Whenever we hear or see in the New Testament writing, the writing of the Apostle Paul, Peter, and John, instructions to the early church concerning work, you have no hint of this sense of sacred calling. What you do have is a lot of exhortations in terms of whatever you do, do as though you're working for God Himself. If you are a slave, you honor your master and you be a great slave, as though you are serving God. Now that sounds very strange to us, but that is the teaching of both Paul and Peter. If you're a master, you basically treat your slaves as though they are yourself. You're not superior to them as a Christian. Basically, you care for them. You lay down your life for them. The same is true with husbands and wives, so forth and so on. People often ask the question, why does not the New Testament make a bigger deal of the evil of slavery? And the way in which I respond to that is this. It's because there are bigger fish to fry. The real issue is not social status or class, as the world sees it. The real issue is the way in which we see it in terms of whatever our role is. If you basically are in a position of power socially, the way you see that power is the issue, not whether you have the power or not. If you are basically in a position where you are subservient in the eyes of the world, the issue is not your position. The issue is the way you see yourself. James says, let those of humble estate recognize that in the eyes of God, they are liberated and free. And let those who are wealthy, James says, let them recognize that they are humble before God. The way we see our role is more important than basically what our role is in society. Vocation, I would argue, is this. It's not our calling, but rather a context for the exercise of our calling. Our calling is basically to work whatever we do as unto the Lord. And to, as we're going to see next week, hopefully, the quality of work that we produce is a very big part of what it means to work as a Christian, no matter what that work might be. Genesis chapter 3, verse 12. The man said, this is after the fall, after the forbidden fruit was taken and eaten from the tree, and the woman gave it to her husband and he ate. The woman whom you gave to me, to be with me, she gave me from the tree and I ate. And the lesson I take away from this passing of the buck here is our third point in the biblical work ethic. Take responsibility for the whole truth. One of the first steps and responsibilities we have in terms of our work is, are we willing to audit what we do and audit our own relationship with what we do accurately. Will we take responsibility? Will we tell the whole story? Of course, what Adam is saying here is absolutely true. You know, he just is leaving out the most important part. And that's the fact that he accepted it. That he basically went along with it. It is very easy for us to speak the part of the truth that suits our reputation and our posture and leave out the part that doesn't. I've mentioned this book several times, Mistakes Were Made But Not By Me. Two psychologists, these aren't necessarily Christians. I don't know if they're believers or not, but the book is invaluable, I think. Where they say basically this: we tend to reconstruct our recollection of our behavior in the past to justify the credibility of our present decisions. And over the years, in terms of our legal system, judges have come to recognize, the court system has come to recognize, that eyewitness accounts really don't mean much. This is why we need forensic, hard scientific evidence. Too often, people who believe they saw something, it didn't exist. And the argument that these two psychologists make is this: most of us remember our past in such a way that it gives support and credibility for our present commitments. In other words, we justify our present by reconstructing our memory of the past. We have a selective memory. I've told this story before, but I'll say it again because it fits. In the case of one of the authors, she was talking about her experience as a child growing up, sitting on her father's lap, reading, having him read from the book O. It was a children's book. And she said, I could have sworn on a Bible that I knew exactly what it was like to sit on his lap, have him read that book. When she was doing research for a book she was writing as an adult, she came across one of the original copies, first editions of the book O. It was written several years after her father died. Now, she was shocked by that, because in her memory, she had linked the experience of that book and sitting in her father's lap. She could have sworn by it, but yet it couldn't have happened. In the book, they cite a number of examples of court cases where convicted criminals have been exonerated by DNA evidence, and the attorneys that convicted them, the prosecutors, would still continue to swear they didn't make a mistake. They were guilty, even though the DNA made it impossible for them to be guilty in some cases. But the point is, most of us have an unconscious ability in our protective mechanisms of our mind to reconstruct past decisions in such a way it suits our present image, our and vindicates our present commitments. I can remember I think the world of my children. I'm always bragging on them, and I'm convinced that they grew up perfectly. They did not have any flaws. I know they had some flaws. But whenever I'm bragging about my kids to someone and they hear about it, they, as my daughter Debbie will say, Dad, that's not the way it was. We weren't that good. And as I reflect on this book and other things that I know about my selective memory, I'm quite sure she's right. That the way I want to see them, the way I need to see them, is the way I do see them and justify it by reconstructing a lot of the evidence. And I just have to wonder how much of the rest of my life is just one big fantasy. But that is not something that we can laugh at, but it's serious. The more I think about it, the more I'm aware of the fact that our mind has a very powerful mechanism to recreate history in a way that fits.
Well, as a culture, we do the same thing. We try to rewrite history. history is written by the one that wins the war.
That is so true. I mean, when we hear about religious sects that actually behead people who are not from their sect, and would torture and slaughter. I mean, we're talking about today's news now. Torture and slaughter women and children, and say that they are doing this for the glory of God. I mean, what is our reaction?
You've got to be kidding.
Exactly. But did you realize that in 1569, English troops, in persecuting the Irish, massacred all Catholics they found and beheaded them and put the heads row on row to the path of their commander's tent? Earl of Essex killed 400 women and children as a part of the persecution of the Irish. Lord Grey killed 600 Spanish troops who were protecting Irish. Not only after they had given up, they killed the troops who had given up, and they killed all the people they were protecting. And the Queen said, basically, "You have been chosen as instruments for God's glory." And I haven't even gotten to Oliver Cromwell yet. Oliver Cromwell is celebrated as a hero for Christians. But when you look at his record, there are some dark pages in that record. When we basically roll our eyes at ISIS, we have conveniently forgotten a whole lot of our own history, which was pretty much similar. Now, again, was that a different age? Yes. But people are people, and those things actually happened. We just conveniently forget them, yes.
There's one big difference. The atrocities that have been committed by Christians were not based on the Bible. Nobody made an effort to base them on the Bible.
I wish that were true, Gunther. I wish that were true. When you hear the embarrassing episodes of the way in which Calvinists treated Baptists as heretics, the best treatment of a good Baptist was prolonged immersion.
Boils down to interpretation.
Right.
How they interpret it.
Exactly.
This is very crucial for today's class, or any class in a church. Is there anything in Christ's teaching that gives support for that?
None at all.
I rest my case.
But there are people who thought it did.
Yeah.
There are people, and I would disagree with them. I mean, I wouldn't say that Cromwell had a case for his torturing of Catholics, but nonetheless, people who were good people otherwise really saw things in ways that were strange to us. Yes?
To the point of wishful thinking, there's a commercial out, I think it's Prudential, and it's being run right now, and it's an experiment where the professor asks the group to pick, talk about their past, and put colors, negative is green and positive, or negative is red and positive is blue, something like that. And you have a smattering of 50-50 for red and blue in the past. And then he says, "Now tell us about your future," and everybody is positive. It's almost all whatever the positive color. The point he makes is that we are trying to align you with reality. And as an insurance company, they are interested in what really will happen. And so when you make the point about selective memory, it's important to recall the past in order to understand the future.
Yes, yes. The past, if nothing else, should humble us significantly. And when we are quick to confess other people's sins, we need to be as quick to confess our own. The call of the flesh is to serve no master. As G.K. Chesterton said, if I can get it right, poor people often complain about being poorly governed. Rich people complain about being governed at all. And there's a sense in which our flesh does not want to submit to anything. The call of the world is to serve two masters, to basically serve God and mammon. That is, to be rich and be the richest person in the cemetery when we're at the end, and to find our life and our status and what we have, and at the same time be a good Christian. And in America, there are a lot of people who are doing that. But Scripture calls us to serve one master. And that means that everything else must fall under that umbrella. And that is the challenge, one of the challenges in terms of Christian ethics. There's one more point. The fourth point in the biblical work ethic. Don't expect it to be easy. Genesis chapter 3. Cursed is the ground because of you. In toil you will eat of it all the days of your life. Both thorns and thistles it shall grow for you. And you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you will eat bread till you return to the ground. And of course the account of the fall in Genesis chapter 3 tells Adam that even though he has these responsibilities, they're now going to be frustrated. And I think, again, a part of this overarching mythical picture of what life is like, we all know that too well. Don't make the mistake of thinking work is the curse. It's the environment in which work takes place. And work will oftentimes be pleasant, oftentimes be rewarding, will come easy even. But for almost all of us, if we've lived long enough, we recognize that sometimes work is just difficult and fruitless in terms of what we do. Without hard work, nothing grows but weeds. And sometimes with hard work, we still get weeds. And we've got to be willing, as Christians, to persevere through that. The interesting testimony of the New Testament, and not just the New Testament, the Old Testament saints as well, is the perseverance and faithfulness of God's people even when there were no results. Isaiah chapter 6. Isaiah is commissioned by God saying, go into all the world, basically, and preach the gospel. And then the verse that just follows says, and by the way, no one's going to respond to you. I'm just telling you ahead. I think it's significant in the great commission that Jesus gives to his disciples to go into all the world and make disciples. He doesn't say you're going to be successful. He says, remember, I will always be with you. And in their lives, they were going to see less success than those who, and generations that followed after them. And yet, they did have the assurance that God was with them even when there was not fruit or success. So, next week, what I want to do is spend a lot of time talking about specific positive examples of ethics at work.
Okay.